From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
I think we can change some of our rituals that we do in a way that are more meaningful for people, they're more helpful. And I believe all religions have to change with the times. We have to keep growing. Just think of when Galileo was living and how he wasn't believed in, and then science came and finally he was. So growing is what it's all about.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you. Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Joyce Rupp. She is well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She serves as a consultant for the Boundless Compassion Program. Joyce Rupp is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Praying Our Goodbyes, Open the Door, Return to the Root, Jesus, Friend of My Soul, and Jesus, Companion in My Suffering. Her award-winning books include Boundless Compassion, Fly While You Still Have Wings, and Anchors for the Soul. She's a member of the Servite community, the Servants of Mary. And today we're talking about her most recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey, which is the third volume following after Jesus, Friend of My Soul, and Jesus, Companion in My Suffering. Joyce Rupp, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here and appreciate your having me.
Well, as a way into our conversation, I have asked you to read one of these Lenten reflections from Jesus' Guide of My Life. So if you would, please.
I'll do it. Thank you. This is titled At the Table of the Unwanted. Some of those who enter the banquet of heaven are undoubtedly the ones I do not expect to be there. It's really not surprising. Jesus chose to welcome persons on the sidelines. The unacceptable ones whom the more conventional and properly bred think less of and tend to shun. One Lent, I chose to deliberately place myself among people I either did not feel comfortable being around or whom I did not enjoy. I tried my best to go toward everyone with a welcoming spirit. I engaged in this practice at gatherings or when shopping. I also did so during prayer when I thought of certain people I gauged to be unpleasant. When I felt like turning away from others, I remembered the banquet from this gospel and turned toward them instead, albeit sometimes reluctantly and having to give myself a whopping push in that direction. I discovered how valuable it is to sit at the table of the unwanted. I learned how smug and patronizing I can be. I was humbled by realizing I was the one unwelcome by some of those who sat there. I felt a common bond in knowing that all of us had been wounded in some way. We were the poor, crippled, and lame. Some adverse aspect prevented each of us from being all we could be. No wonder we all sat at the same table.
And that is our guest, Joyce Rupp, reading from her recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. The reason why I wanted to start there is because I think oftentimes when we talk about Lent, or when we talk about Lent with people that are not part of Christian communities that celebrate Lent, there can be a kind of blurring of the lines between righteousness and self-righteousness, a kind of holier-than-thou attitude that you're talking about in this particular reflection. And so I wanted to start there to invite you to talk about this very active exercise that you did of trying to place yourself in the position and in solidarity with and in sympathy with those who are unwanted. Talk to me about the genesis of this reflection and what it was like to write it and to live it.
Well, I really appreciate that question, David. I I always say that Thomas Merton was one of my spiritual mentors. And I started reading him when I was in my 20s. And I have to say, I was pretty self-righteous by then. I was a young nun and I thought, well, yeah, I know everything. But I started reading Merton. And what really attracted me was his honesty about his shadow side and his incompleteness. And I realized that was what I was really connecting with more than some of the other pieces that I would naturally have been drawn to. And then when I wrote my book, Praying Our Goodbyes, I'm a very private person and I'm introverted. And so I don't share a lot of my inner self real easily. In the past, I haven't anyway. And so I was writing that book, and that's been, gosh, 25 years ago, I think. And I sent it out to some of my readers, and I wanted to get some feedback. And so one of them was a chaplain at a hospital, and he wrote back to me, and he said, I think you need to write a lot more about how you felt about your brother drowning. All I did was have a statement in there about him. And I was really irritated, and I thought, I don't want to reveal my whole self to all these people out there that are reading. But then I thought, well, Joyce, you did ask him to read and give you feedback. And so I thought about that. And so I did. I have a whole section about, I was 25 and he was 23 when he drowned. So it was pretty traumatic for me. And I had a really hard time reconciling my sense of God. I had a pretty Pollyanna viewpoint. If you're good, everything good happens, blah, blah, blah. And so I had to really come to terms with how that drowning happened in my life and how I was going to still be in relationship with this divine being. And so the amazing thing that happened for me is that when I wrote more of my experience of that in that deeper way, that's the thing most readers would tell me that they appreciated about the book, was that very part about my brother and how I struggled and how I felt about that. It took me 15 years to finally reconcile my own spiritual understanding of that. And so that really has opened me up to see that at a deeper level, we have a lot of the same joys and the same sorrows and the struggles and the differences and the feelings that we have. And I've learned so much from the people that I've met at conferences and the retreats I've given. And I just listen to them and I just admire them for being so vulnerable. And my ethnicity is 99% German, so vulnerable is not my ethnicity, let me tell you. So I've had to learn that. And I realize the more, I don't mean bleeding all over the pages, but just being vulnerable, being my truest self. And so that's really a long response to your wonderful question that I know I just need to be authentic. I guess that's how I kind of summarize that. Being authentic. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Joyce Rupp. She is well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. It's the third in a series, beginning with Jesus, Friend of My Soul, and Jesus, Companion in My Suffering. I want to linger with this for just a moment because you're talking about vulnerability. And first of all, I want to express my deepest sympathies and condolences for the loss of your brother. And the effect in the wake of the loss of your brother, I think, is worth lingering with for a moment. Because as you were telling me this story, one of the things that came to my mind was the philosopher David Hume. And one of the things David Hume says in his dialogues concerning religious understanding is that if we're talking about any kind of divine entity at all, it must be an indifferent one. And so I want to ask you, in the wake of the loss of your brother, did you wrestle with divine indifference, with the notion that if there is a powerful God moving the universe, that God simply doesn't care? And how did you move out of that indifference into the space where you are now, where you are walking the way with Jesus?
Yeah, wow. Wow, that's a biggie. My relationship with the divine being is radically different from when I was young. And yes, I did struggle with, I just struggled, like, first of all, is there a God? Is there some divine being? And my brother was a really good person. And it was that theodicy question. But I have this strong foundation that just stayed with me as I went with all those questions. And my foundation came, and I wrote about this in a little in the intro to that Jesus Guide of My Life, that I was in second grade. I went to a little country school, little farm country school, and we had Franciscan sisters. And in second grade, I'm sure this sister was about 18 years old. They sent them out when they were like out of high school, I think, to teach us. But anyway, we loved her because she was young. And what she said over and over again to us was, Jesus is your friend, and you can speak in your heart to Jesus. And somehow that really stayed with me. And I had the chores I did then were feeding the chickens. And so when I fed the chickens, I was talking to him, I suppose, like an imaginary friend, although I never pictured him. I just knew in my heart there was some presence that was there. And then when I was in high school, I'd come home from a date and I'd stand at my bedroom window and I'd look at the stars and I'd think, there's so much more here than me. What is this mystery? So when my brother died, then I was 25 and all of this happened, I was just heartbroken. And there was so little written about grief at that time. I didn't know how to deal with my emotions. But what I did, and this was just, I think, an inner movement of resilience in me, but I got a notebook and I was teaching school at that time. I only taught about 5 years. But anyway, I found this tree out behind the school and I would sit under that tree and I would just write. I just wrote. And a lot of my writing, I just wrote to this. I don't even know if I called this being God at the time. I just wrote, but I wrote to someone. And that was just such a turning for me because it moved into relationship again. And I would say that's what my spiritual connection and how I moved out of that was. I moved into relationship again. It wasn't like there was a non-being. There was a someone or a something that today I call the great love. It's the great love is my divine being, holy wisdom. But it took a long time for me to get there. And I didn't have a lot of guidance at that time. Since then, I know the value of a spiritual guide, but I didn't then. So I wrote my book, Then Praying Our Goodbyes, when I was 35. So I actually was 40 by the time it came out. So it was a good 15 years that I couldn't write it before then, but I did.
Let me ask you a follow-on to that, because you've mentioned that you have thought and I know that you work as a spiritual companion to others. And so as you think back on this time when you had imagined this spiritual companion to whom you were writing, how does that help to shape the way in which now you companion with others and the way in which that spiritual director that you worked with during this time helped you? And how does that experience help to shape your spiritual direction with others?
Oh, tremendously, tremendously. Really, I have such a variety of people who've come to me for spiritual guidance. And honestly, I just can accept people where they are, no matter what they are going on. I mean, I have had people come to me who've been struggling seeing ghosts, and I've had people who are on the real, very traditional side of Roman Catholicism, everywhere in between, and a great variety of religions. And I always think we're just all on this journey, and I'm a companion. I'm not someone I'm not even pointing the way. I'm just with you in this as you find the way that you feel is pointed to you. And so that was, yes, it's a very freeing thing because I wanted to be respected for where I was on my journey and not be judged by it, or you don't have any faith, blah, blah, blah. I believe it with all my heart. I just think we're all full of mystery. And it's just so wonderful how life evolves for us if we have people who support us, who believe in us.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Joyce Rupp. She's well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She serves as a consultant for the Boundless Compassion Program, and she is the author of numerous best-selling books. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying this conversation, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Joyce Rupp. She is well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She serves as a consultant for the Boundless Compassion Program, and she's the author of numerous best-selling books. Today, we're talking about her most recent book, the completion of a trilogy called Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. Well, in our first segment, we were talking about how you came into the process of writing. And one of the things that really jumped out to me to ask you is, it sounds as if, for you, writing is not simply an activity of communication, but it is a form of prayer. You mentioned that you were writing to, you didn't even know what you were imagining, but you thought maybe it was the divine. And so if the divine is your audience, it sounds like writing is a form of prayer. When I say that to you, does that land right for you, or would you say it in a different way? But if I've got it right, I'd love to hear more about it.
I would say I write in the context of prayer. I don't know if I would say my writing itself. It depends on what I'm writing, David. One of my books that I just love that I wrote, I started culling these, like, it took me about 10 years. But all the different names for the divine from all the different traditions and plus literature and music and all over. And I wanted a name, a different name than all the ordinary usual ones for 365 days. And so I got that many. And so then every morning I would take one of those names and I just sit with that name. And I think they're like 6 or 8 lines is what I wrote. And I addressing this particular, whether it was maker of music or whatever it might have been. In my usual writing, what I do is I take about 1.5 to 2 hours in the morning for meditation, some reading, just real quiet time, any interactions there with other people. And then I do some writing after that. So I'd like to hope it comes out of that deeper place, that calmer place within me. A lot of times when I'm stuck, I just say, I know you'll give me the words. And they do come, and I'm surprised. Like, I know other writers, of course, will say this, but honestly, when I get my edited manuscripts back, sometimes I think, I know I didn't write that. And then I look at the original, and I did. And I think, where did that come from? Where did that come from? And I just say, it's bigger than I am. It's bigger. I know it's bigger than I am. And I don't mean that. It's not like some people writing will say they're transcribing. It's not that. It's more just, it's in the context of this sense I have of being united with this much larger presence of love. I guess that's kind of how I'd say it.
So many things there that I want to explore. First of all, what I got from that just now is that when you write, sometimes your writing surprises you. And again, not in a kind of automatic writing kind of way, but when you get your own words back, it's almost astonishing that you wrote that. First of all, did I hear that correctly? And I'd love to hear more about the surprise you feel when you write.
Yeah, I just do. I can't explain. And you're right on when you say that. I just go, where did that come from? At the time I'm writing it, I knew I was writing it and I was editing it and all of that. But then when I read it later on, I think, that was within me somewhere. And see, I think that is within everyone. And that's part of why I love being a spiritual guide or writing inspirational writing, because I think if I can write something that then triggers for someone else, oh, and then they go inside and they think, yes, I understand. And then it connects them with something that they've experienced. And I get a lot of, in social media, I get a lot of emails and contacts from people that I don't know. And they will write and say, what you wrote and such, that's just what I needed to hear, or that made me think of this, or that happened for me. And so for me, writing is, I always say, the deeper down we go, the more alike we are than different. And I think a good writer, and that's when I read something I really like, it's they've taken me to a place where inside myself that connects with that. In fact, I read someplace some time ago that if you really like something in a book, it's that you already knew it. It's just that reader, that writer is naming it for you. And I think that's pretty true.
So I've had lots of conversations with vowed religious, and one of the sort of central terms that comes up again and again in those conversations is the idea of vocation, praying about and discerning what it is that you're called to do. And as you describe, you spend your mornings 90 minutes in meditation and reading, and then the writing flows out of that. It's pretty clear that you have discerned that writing for you is a vocation. It's a part of what you have been called to do. And I think my listeners would be interested in hearing a little bit about that journey to your coming to terms with that vocation.
Well, you know, I never think of it as a vocation. I just think of it as something that I have to do. But when I was in my 20s, I read Rilke's book, Letters to a Young Poet. And I love that book. And in that book, one of the things Rilke said, and I was just starting to write then. I was writing more poetry than anything then. Anyway, but he says you have to want to have a passion for writing so much that you just cannot not write. And I actually started praying in the morning. I'd say, just help me want to write so much I cannot not write. And now sometimes I think, I wish I hadn't prayed that, because now I just cannot not write. It's like, I just keep writing. I said, I'm going to be on my deathbed. And if I'm conscious, I'll say, does anybody have a pen and paper? You know, it's like, but that got me started. And I feel called to write. And I love to write. I love when I pick up my pen in the morning, because I usually do longhand with some things first. And it just feels right for me. And I love it. And I love when words come together. Words fascinate me, and the meaning that words can have, and the power that words can have for better or for not so good. But yeah, so I do. And it was because of that. And I remember I was in my 40s. And one day I thought, oh, I think that prayer got answered. I do want to write so much. And as with other writers, I know other authors, we give up that. You give up social life sometimes to write. And you have these deadlines. Or for myself, sometimes I get so oriented toward something I want to write that I just put everything else aside in order to do it. And I don't resent it, but I know that that's the price to be paid for it. So,
well, it strikes me how much you love words. And we're talking about this in the context of prayer and in the context of a relationship with God. But even if you just open up the very first page of the Bible, God is a God of words. God spoke and the universe leapt into being. And God communicates to us through this majestic story that's collected in all the different books of the Bible. So you're really tapping into something very deep here when you say that you will push other things aside to get to those words, because I think that is really a touch point for the divine for you. Now, these are my words, not yours. So as I say that, does that sound right, or would you say it in a different way?
I would say it that way, David, because when words come together, and not just my words, but the words like of other poets and writers, a really good writer, I just love someone that writes well. And my heart just goes, this is such good writing. And I just finished A Covenant of Water, you know, and I thought, oh, 700 and some pages, you know. But honestly, Verghese, he is the most fabulous writer. I would have read 1,000 pages, I think, because he's such a good writer. And so, yes, words are. And that's why, just going back to the naming of the divine, I think there are just endless words for this presence that fills the universe. And unfortunately, mainline churches have been so boxed in on how, and I think it really stilts it limits people's connection with bringing this process into a meaningful way in their lives. Because just for instance, in my own Roman Catholic tradition, it just, every time it just pains me when we have a liturgy and the reading is from the Book of Wisdom, who is referred to as she, I never hear any celebrant ever talk about the feminine face of God, unless it's with Mary. And it just, I think, how can you be so limited? How so limited in that way? And so that's one thing I think with words, that we can do so much in describing how we relate to this divine being, and also how we want to share our experience of how we have that relationship in our lives, in our very ordinary everyday lives. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Joyce Rupp. She is well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. Well, we've been talking about the way in which words can capture and words can connect. And I'm aware that at the very beginning of your book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, you mentioned that as you were meditating, a series of words came to you. And I'm going to read your list right quick: showing, teaching, testifying, pointing, forgiving, encouraging, explaining, leading, extending, attending, understanding, cautioning, influencing, finding, inviting, and midwifing. And all of these were brought together for you in the context of following the way, the path of Jesus on this course through Lent to the cross and then to Easter. So I want to ask you about these words. As you were meditating and these words bubbled up for you, tell us how these began to weave together for you in terms of meditating on this thing that we call Lent.
Yeah. Well, when I was in my early 20s in my community, we always had a 5-day retreat every year. And we always had a Jesuit who led the retreat. And the themes were always very similar. The thing that I've always thanked them for and appreciated is that they taught me how to enter into the Gospels in a way that was personal and meaningful and not just more creeds and rules and doctrine and that sort of thing. And how they did that is, and I loved it because I'm a very visual person, is that they would take a gospel story. Let's just say the one where the woman kept menstruating for 12 years, and then she touches the hem of Jesus' garment. And they would do this whole meditation with us to have us picture ourselves being in that scene. And first of all, we would look at what was happening, and then we would try to hear what was happening. And then we would imagine ourselves being the woman. And then we would imagine ourselves being Jesus. So it's like you got in there and they'd use the five senses. What did you see? What did you hear? What did you smell? What did you touch? And out of that, this person of Jesus, see, I think people just keep Jesus so divine out there someplace that for me, his full humanity is what draws me to the goodness that he so exemplifies. And so here is this person, this energy, this charismatic person. He had this energy that he knew that he was connected to this woman in this crowd. And so that is how those words come to me. So if I'm spending time with one of those passages and I try to get inside, what was it like for the people? What did they hear? What must they have known? And then, so how did Jesus respond? I remember one time I was talking with a group, and I was talking about Jesus being angry, and this woman got so upset with me because Jesus could not have been angry, kind of thing. It was like I was this heretic saying, yeah, he had a human emotion. Anyway, that's beside the point. But just that whole thing of, to really get humanly inside of a story and do it from both head and heart is so important. And that's, so those are how those tending and teaching and midwifing, because I saw him as this person who was doing that, accepting, receiving, sharing all those things. Yeah.
Well, and let me return to one of these terms that you've utilized here, and it ties in with what you were saying earlier about wisdom and the feminine face of God. This term, Jesus as a midwife and midwifing. Talk to us, because you've also described yourself as a spiritual midwife. This seems like a very resonant term for you. So I'd like to hear more how you think about midwifing generally, but then also in a spiritual context, but then how it's applying here to Lent as well.
Yeah, it goes back to something we were talking about earlier about being vulnerable in a way. But see, a midwife can never do the birthing for the mother. She has to be very skilled, very knowledgeable, very present. She urges the woman to give birth. She cares for this woman as fully as she can. But in no way can she ever actually birth that child herself. And that's, and we were talking earlier about people who are self-righteous. I know what you need and want, and this is what you ought to have. Midwifing gets away from all of that. And Jesus was so invitational. I love the story of the woman at the well, because Jesus just leads her along and he questions. And, you know, he could have at the very beginning said, look, I know what you need and here's what it is, and now go and tell the people and do it. But instead, he drew all of that out from her until she saw it for herself. I just love that story. And I think that the story of Zacchaeus is the same thing. He's up in this tree and he's just trying to get a look. He doesn't want to get involved. And Jesus sees him there, but he draws him down. And he, you know, instead of saying, you know, I hear that you're a crook and hey, you know, you ought to do that. He says, hey, can I come to your house and have dinner with you? It's so different. And that's what I see as a midwifery kind of thing is, hey, can I come with, can we sit down and talk about this? And I'd love to know what is going on inside of you. And it just, and really a listen, it's more of a listening, caring response than it is, I'm going to tell you what to do. Even though there are times when Jesus is very clear in his parables, his teachings are really very forward. But with people, individuals, he's very much, I think, a midwife.
Well, in this, I'm hearing a through line of relationship. Jesus is not this distant, but rather Jesus is getting to know us. And like a good midwife, knows the person that she's tending to well enough to be able to tell them, and now you need to push. And when I say that, am I putting too much weight on the metaphor, or does that sound right to you?
No, that's exactly, you're just right on, because that's why the first book I did in the trilogy was Friend of My Soul, because I wanted to establish relationship before anything of the teachings, which is usually people do in reverse. Here's what it is, and now you have to do it. And, oh, yes, I think Jesus said that, or Jesus taught that. But establish a relationship. And so all of the meditations in that first book, I began all of them, the title of them, One Who Is, like one who is compassionate, one who is understanding, one who is forgiving. And those were all qualities that I found in the person of Jesus in his life. And then the second one I did on suffering, because I do think that his central quality is compassion. And I studied a lot. I spent 2 years at the Buddhist Institute in Boulder doing some grad work in psychology, but I studied Buddhism when I was there. And I was just blown away with how Buddhism, the central focus is compassion. And I went back to the Gospels and I thought, Jesus is the compassionate one in every way, and not just with suffering, but compassion, as a Buddhist would say, that we are one. We are, I am you and you are me. And that's why I've always said, for my funeral, I want Matthew 25 to be read. Whatever you do to others, you do to me. I think that sums up the whole of Jesus' teaching. And it's very Buddhist.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Today, we're speaking with Joyce Rupp. She's well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey, the third in her trilogy of books on these subjects. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying this conversation, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Joyce Rupp. She is well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She serves as a consultant for the Boundless Compassion Program and is the author of numerous best-selling books. Today, we're talking about her most recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. Throughout our conversation, you've come back again and again to this idea of relationship, that Jesus wants to be in relationship with us. But you've also mentioned, either through social media or through other interactions, the relationships that you have with your readers. And I'm wondering how you have been shaped by those relationships as you have gone about your journey as a writer.
I just couldn't say enough about the people that I've gotten to know and how much they've helped me in many ways. But one of the ways is I'll be working on a book and I think, this is just, why am I working on this? This is like, you know, yaddy yaddy. And I'm just like, yeah. And then I'll get an email from someone and they will say, you know, when I read this in your last book and this, and I think, oh, maybe what I write, maybe it is worth writing. I think most writers go through this, you know, you just say, oh, this sounds like poop and this. And then you come back to it and you go, no, I have to trust this. I have to trust this. But that's just one piece of it. But just the other day, I'm working on something now and on aging, and I was writing a section on harvesting, that this harvest time for older people. And I get this email from someone who is a facilitator in a Boundless Compassion Program. And she just describes a situation with a person she knows, and she's describing it all just like I'm writing about it in the essay on harvesting. So I write to her, I say, Joan, can I use this quote? I mean, it is so, it's like, it's that deeper, yeah, we get it. It's a human to human kind of thing. And that's what it is. You know, a lot of people, most of the people I write to, I've never met. I'm careful. I can't enter into lots of correspondence or I wouldn't be ever doing any writing. But I've had some very significant, powerful emails that have touched my heart deeply. I heard from a man in Zimbabwe last year, and he told me about how he and his wife were just so longing to have children and about the pain of all the miscarriages and how it's been for their relationship. And I was so touched that this man, who doesn't know me at all, would write that. And it was just a powerful message. And it's just people like that that write to me. And what it does for me, it's about the human condition. It confirms for me why I want to pay the price to write, because we need to encourage one another's resilience and one another's ability to be the best of who we can be. I would put it that way. And that's what those messages do for me when they write. It's like, we're all in this together. And there's a lot of joy in the world, but there's tremendous amount of suffering in the world. And I'm just always grateful when I can write back to someone and encourage them, or when they write to me and encourage me in, without even realizing that they're doing that. Relationships with readers are really important, I think. And I would just say I owe so much to them, so much to people who've read my work.
I want to make sure that I heard something correctly in your answer there, and let me say it back to you and see if I've got it right. And if I do, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. So what I heard you saying was that there have been times when you have written something and you may have thought to yourself, and I'm paraphrasing here, oh, it's not so good, but it is what it is, and it kind of goes out into the world. And then someone else, a reader, takes this piece that you thought was not so good, and they latch onto it and say, this is what I needed for today. And they suddenly see a treasure in it where you saw something that wasn't necessarily a treasure. First of all, I want to make sure that I heard that correctly. And then if I did, I'd love for you to reflect on what it's like, because this brings us back to the idea of surprise and being surprised by your own writing, that someone else would value something so deeply when you thought it was maybe a throwaway line.
Yeah, I would alter that in the sense that I would not have anything published that I didn't believe in or that I didn't think was authentic. But I'll give you an example. I wrote a book called The Cup of Our Life, and I used the cup as a symbol for all that, like the broken cup, the chipped cup, the full cup. And they were all symbols or images of different aspects of our spiritual growth or our journey of life. And when I finished the book, I liked what I had written, but I didn't think I thought other people are going to do a cup. Really? She's using this. But I just thought, I don't know if this is going to go anyplace, but I'm so glad that the company's going to publish it. Well, I think that book has sold maybe 80,000 copies now. It just took off. And what it said for me was, first, the power of the ordinary image in people's lives, if you can give it meaning. And I've learned so much. People have sent me cups. They've written, told me all kinds of things about what the broken cup did for them and how the chipped cup helped them accept the parts of themselves they didn't like or that were hurt. It's been amazing, but that's the kind of thing that I wouldn't have known that book could be, what I wrote in that book could be effective if people hadn't told me. I think if readers knew that, readers who aren't writers, if they know what a gift they give to authors when they write and tell them something that they appreciate about their writing, it's really helpful. It's really helpful.
Well, and I want to now turn this back to the subject of your book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, and this notion of the Lenten journey. And so we've been talking about surprise and the way in which we can be affirmed by words and particularly by the words of strangers. So I'm wondering, as you were engaged in the writing of this and the meditating and the reflecting on Lent, how did your vision of Lent change as a result of writing this book?
Actually, my vision of Lent changed before I wrote any of those books because, and I have to say this in a way that, but I just gotten really tired of the churches always talking about sin. I'm just tired of it. And I'm tired of going to liturgies in my own Roman Catholic tradition. And the first thing they say, okay, everybody, remember your sins now. Here we are gathered. And I think, what if we began and said, let's all say together, 2 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 16, whatever it is. Anyway, remember, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit and that God's Spirit dwells in you. And I think, so my whole point is, if we can talk about, draw forth the goodness in people's lives, then they will be better people. But if we keep bashing them with, you're just the worst people and you're terrible and doing wrong, what is there to inspire them to do better, to want to be more whole and healthy and loving, compassionate people? It's just the opposite way of going at it. So I've been doing that for myself for years. I try, when I start Lent, I want to think of something really positive that I can do and be. And what is there in me that I can, that needs to be drawn forth more rather than, you've been such a louse this last year kind of thing. So that's why I think addressing the qualities of Jesus and the teachings, because if people look at the book, the teachings are all positive teachings. They're hard teachings. Pay the price. You have to be generous, be forgiving, but it's not beating people over the head with you're so miserable, non-forgiving person. I just can't go that way anymore.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Joyce Rupp. She's well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She is the author of numerous best-selling books, and today we're talking about her most recent one, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. I think some of my listeners may be surprised to hear the criticism that you just gave of the Roman Catholic tradition, given that you are a vowed religious within the Roman Catholic tradition. I think maybe sometimes my listeners might imagine that a person who has dedicated their life to prayer within the Catholic Church and to living within an intentional community within the Catholic Church would be a natural cheerleader for all things of the Church. And so I wonder how you balance those expectations of, this is your life, this is what you have given your life to, versus this is also a source of your frustration and maybe your invitation to others to grow.
Exactly. And growing is the thing. There's always room to grow. And I just remember when we all had to receive communion on the tongue all the time. And some of us just started putting out our hand and saying, hey, you know what? This is we. And finally, it came about. Now we receive in the hand. And so there are ways to change and grow and to do it in a way that's respectful. I certainly believe there's evil and sin in the world. It's just that I want to go about this in a different way. I think we can change some of our rituals that we do in a way that are more meaningful for people. They're more helpful. And I believe all religions have to change with the times. We have to keep growing. Just think of when Galileo was living and how he wasn't believed in, and then science came and finally he was. So growing is what it's all about.
Well, and that strikes me, in fact, from your very words in your book, Jesus Guide of My Life, in the reflection titled Ready to Grow. You say followers of the gospel teachings are not required to live out of a suitcase, but we will most surely be continually on the move interiorly if we intend to live those teachings with depth and authenticity. So you're calling your own church community back to depth and authenticity. And you say pack a bag because it's gonna start to move you in some ways. You're not going to do things I think it was Yaroslav Pelikan that said that traditionalism was the religion of the dead coming to stifle the living. And you're trying to bring a living religion or a living authenticity back into this. These are my words, not yours. When I say this, does this sound right? Or would you say it in a different way?
No, I just think Pope Francis to me is an example of that. I think he's really trying to get people to live out of a suitcase and they still want to live all boxed in. And that's why they're giving him such a hard time. Some people are. But he really, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to grow the church. And I think there are a number of us that really are cheering him on and saying, yes, we want to grow with you. So
I love that so much. So you feel encouraged by the papacy of Pope Francis. You feel like you're cheering him on, but it almost sounds as if you feel like he's cheering you on as well.
Definitely. I want him to do more cheering, but he's cheering us often.
Well, and I think for a lot of people, living in that tension would be exhausting. And so let me ask you and others that live in this tension of growth, of being on the move inside, as we've been talking about, what do you do for self-care? How do you keep yourself buoyant in a world that oftentimes wants to start with the sin model instead of starting with the temple model, to use your words from earlier?
Yeah, my world is bigger than just what we're talking about today. And I love nature and I have good friends and there's just all kinds of ways to resource oneself and to keep balance. And the reality is at my age, I just figure things work themselves out in time. I used to get really angry about stuff in the church when I was 40 and now, hey, I'm just going to let it be. It will happen. And what's going to happen will happen. It doesn't mean I don't care. I'm just not going to carry the burden on my shoulders.
What I really like about that answer is that it encapsulates a lot of what you're drawing together in your book, Jesus Guide of My Life, because you mentioned here that you were frustrated in your 40s and now you feel, you know, what will happen. That's almost like a Lent into Easter sort of journey. I'm hearing resurrection in what you're saying, that whatever was frustrated in you before has been somehow resurrected and transformed in your current understanding of things. And I love your phrasing that your life is bigger than what we're talking about right now. When I make these kind of connections and draw these parallels, does that sound right or would you say it in a different way? And if it does sound right, I'd love to hear your thoughts about it.
I love what you just said about resurrection, about Easter, because I am really a hope-filled person. And I believe that. I think because I'm such a nature-oriented person. And right now we're in the fallow time winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, and spring is going to come again. You know, it will. And it may come in a different way than it did last year, but it's life will return. We'll hear birds singing again. All of that will happen. And I believe that I am a hope-filled person.
For my last question for you, I'd like to return to something that you mentioned earlier. You talked about an earlier work written well before Jesus Guide of My Life that we're talking about today. And it's the work where you came up and researched and talked about the 365 different names of God. And I'm wondering, in the process of that research, were there a couple of favorite names that stuck with you? What are some of your favorite names for God?
Well, goodness. There were so, you know, I called it Fragments of Your Ancient Name out of a Rilke poem, but I have a hard time with that because the name I always go back to is Sophia, which is Thomas Merton talked about Hagia Sophia, which means holy wisdom. It's a Greek for holy wisdom. And Sophia has been my name for the divine for so long. I love a lot of beautiful names, Dancer of the Soul or Midwife of Our Heart, all of those. But I'm just, and I also like to, another one is just the great love. I think that's so wonderful. The great love is another beautiful one for me. It's just, I don't know. There were some that I didn't like, as I'm trying to think right now. So when I didn't, well, I think I put in judge for one of them, because that's what some people, the judge. And I thought, yeah, I don't resonate with that one too much at all. But for the most part, there are some just very beautiful names for this sacred presence that I do believe fills the universe. What should be another great topic for another time is, who is this divine presence in a universe that keeps expanding?
Joyce Rupp, I have to say, I am so grateful for your sharing the wisdom that you have gained from your meditations and reflections and from your writing about this great love that we are talking about and that we are moving towards in our Lenten journey to Easter. I am so grateful for the time and care that went into the writing of this book, the third now, completing a trilogy, Jesus Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. Thank you for the time that it took to write it, but thank you especially for the time that you took today to talk about it with me and my listeners.
And thank you. I so appreciate our conversation. It's been stimulating for me, and I'll be thinking of it for days to come, thinking, I'm so glad I haven't thought about that in a while, or I haven't thought about that at all. And so thank you, David. It was just really a pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for those kind words. We've been speaking today with Joyce Rupp. She's well known for her work as a writer, retreat leader, and spiritual midwife. She serves as a consultant for the Boundless Compassion Program, and she's the author of numerous best-selling books. She's a member of the Servite community, the Servants of Mary. Today, we're talking about her most recent book, Jesus, Guide of My Life, Reflections for the Lenten Journey. Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park, here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.